Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Welcome to Bristol's first podcast. Yes, the first we were. Dialect goes out every week now at our relatively new Friday afternoon 2 p.m. slot. Here on the one and only BCFM 93.2. This week, backed by popular demand, Somerset's very own daredevil aviator who believes he's a victim of a miscarriage of justice, and possibly several. We talked to flying vet Morris Kirk about shortcomings in the medical profession and also the network of litigants in person, Victims Unite, that's been helping him. More from our weekly series with Peruvian-born US filmmaker Alan Frankovich, who died in mysterious circumstances in Houston Airport Customs Hall in 1994. Alongside the feature films of Greek-born French filmmaker Costa Gavras, Frankovich's 1970s and 1980s documentaries give us a deep insight into a criminal side of the Western intelligence agencies such as MI6, the CIA, the Israeli Mossad, and NATO intelligence, blowing people up and then blaming it on someone else. Black operations under the secret orders of prime ministers, presidents, and royalty. Plus, we have the weekly What's On Guide and Song of the Week from Jeff Sparks. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen's Square. Dialect recommends the volunteer-run Bristol Bully Watch helpline, aimed mainly at school children and parents. The number's 01454 318 753, and we'll have a reminder of phone numbers for both Volunteering Bristol and Bully Watch at the end of the show. So we start this week with Morris Kirk, the daredevil aviator. You don't mind me calling you that, I hope, Morris?
I'd need notice for a question like that.
Okay. We've been talking to you a couple of occasions over the last few weeks, and we kind of finished the last time with you saying that there was quite a lot to say about the medical profession. Do you want to kick us off on that?
Yes. Most people in our community call for our doctor for help and have little to argue about. I went through a frightening experience 3 years ago. I was having a cup of tea in the garden, and the police helicopter was hovering over the top, and I was surrounded by policemen with guns, and I was locked away in Cardiff Prison. Within a few weeks, I was hauled before a court. I was in a wheelchair because I was on hunger strike, because nobody would explain what was going on. And the judge read out a part of a psychiatric report that I was to be sectioned under the Mental Health Act. Now, this really frightened me, because I was then whisked away to a psychiatric prison in South Wales, Caswell Clinic in Bridgend. And because I did not consider I had any mental disorders, I was really terrified. I have never been so frightened in all my life.
Not even with some of the aviation stunts you've done, this kind of thing.
I used to be a climbing instructor, and we had some really serious things go wrong. I've had problems with the parachute falling at 120 miles an hour. I've experienced lots of serious things. But this was a different fear. And to be locked up in a psychiatric secure unit when you consider there is nothing wrong with you, and you've been accused of selling a machine gun, and they're using that as an excuse to have you detained in custody, all of which was complete nonsense. I was very, very frightened, but and
Morris,
I've never
Morris,
recovered.
Morris, you would say that, wouldn't you? Because I think everybody who's in a psychiatric ward, almost to a man or a woman, would say, actually, I shouldn't be here, I'm sane.
No. There were lots of prisoners there who were there for the right purpose. They were grateful to be there. Their families were grateful that they were there, and they were getting good service. But I was there for political purposes. The Gulag card had been played. And I had a problem, and I still have, with the South Wales Police, and they used the Gulag card. I mean, if you are a political dissident, what do they do with you? If you complain, you go to the authorities and you use whatever laws are available to you through the civil or criminal courts. And there comes a point when they ignore you. And then they try and ridicule you. And if they can't stop you, they then play the gulag card, like they did with Solzhenitsyn and others.
So you're sort of comparing yourself with a kind of Soviet, Soviet dissident?
A miniature. In miniature.
Okay, so what makes you think that you were perfectly sane when you had a doctor diagnose you as sectionable?
Well, I'm talking about this about because this is going on across the country now. I now have, you remember I mentioned Sabine McNeil of Victims Unite. Well, because of my experiences 3 years ago, I've now dug up and researching lots of other people who, for political purposes, in our British prisons, are being plucked and put in psychiatric prisons to avoid court cases. It is the way to avoid the evidence that may be highly political or highly sensitive due to serious incompetence by the borough council, the local police force, a member of parliament, all sorts of things. And they actually recommended, I was in the psychiatric prison for 3 months, and I had my wife bringing in food and water for me to eat and drink because I was very worried they were going to fill me up with medicine. Now, because of my medical background, I knew that if I admitted taking any form of treatment whilst in a psychiatric hospital, I was then an official patient. But I was under Section 35, which is purely observation. And when their 3 months ran out, each month I had to go before the court, and the psychiatrist would write another report. But on the first one, he hadn't even examined me. I wasn't even examined by a psychiatrist. That is what's so frightening. And they are starting to use this system in South Wales on people I know. I actually have a dossier on the subject now, and it's getting fat.
Well, Morris, I mean, what you're saying about, I mean, certainly one of there's some big questions right this week actually being raised about Gwent Police in the South Wales Argus on Saturday the 8th of December 2012. There's an article, Gwent Police Commissioner appoints ex-colleague to £25,000 role. They're saying Gwent's new police and crime commissioner wants to appoint a retired police officer he's known for 30 years as his deputy. Ian Johnston told the first meeting of the Gwent Police and Crime Panel that he intends to appoint Gwent's first financial investigator, Paul Harris, to be the region's deputy police and crime commissioner. There have been concerns nationwide that police and crime commissioners, the PCCs, have been appointing contacts, friends and former colleagues to the role. But speaking to the Argus, Mr Johnston denied that Mr Harris, who will earn £52,000 a year on a contract of 37 hours a week, was a crony. I see it as extremely sensible and pragmatic that I would appoint someone that I know and trust, Mr Johnston said. Now, this is two former police officers in charge of overseeing Gwent Police. That strikes me as actually rather dangerous when you've got the police overseeing the police. That's one of the problems we've come across with the independent so-called police complaints authority. So, that story in the Argus this week would tend to echo what you're saying, that things across the other side of, from us anyway here in Bristol, where we're recording this, the other side of the Severn Estuary aren't too good.
I don't read as much of that as you do into that. I know that we're desperate for expertise, and a retired person from the police force being pulled in as another is not as bad as it sounds. I'm very right wing, and I believe in supporting a policeman's job, and I wouldn't just generalize in what you're saying. It's an alarm, your eyebrows go up when you hear about it, but you have to examine each one in
Morris,
turn.
I'm going to have to argue with you here from a sort of slightly more left-wing point of view, because ultimately it's really important that the independent the police and crime commissioner is independent of the police, and quite clearly if it's someone that's overseeing their former colleagues, there've got to be questions about whether they are actually independent.
Well, this is the very subject about the breakdown of law and order within our law courts. I remember when I was a child, you could rely very much on those that ran the law courts. But now, the quality of their integrity is often in doubt. And you are using that argument where 30 years ago, I wouldn't bat an eyelid about what's going on in Gwent. But now I must admit, until I know the details, I'm going to fight you on this one. I'm going to support it.
Okay, fair enough. But anyway, questions remain about that. I mean, certainly it's considered newsworthy that it's now that Gwent Police is being overseen not by people independent, but by former police officers. Tell us about this mental institution that you were incarcerated in. Just remind us where it was again, and describe the place for us, Maurice.
Well, the doctor concerned was virtually in charge, and what alarmed me was that I interviewed all the inmates, because I was getting bored, and I was interviewing to find out about psychiatric disorders, and I think Mr. Nicholson made a very good film about this, and I couldn't but think about it
You mean One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
Exactly. But this doctor was actually grooming prisoners to be taken out of the state prison into his private clinics. And a little more inquiries on the phone, because I'd had access to the phone, I found that he had business links with those that run the South Wales National Health Service HQ in Port Talbot. Quite alarming. But when my 3 months ran out, they had to put me back in the prison. And it was like a holiday for me to get out. Oh, it was wonderful. But then they put me in front of the judge again on the 2nd of December 2009, and they wouldn't let me come up the stairs. I was still in my handcuffs downstairs. By the way, I was found not guilty of the alleged offence of having a machine gun. That was all quashed in court a few weeks later. But in court, that doctor was asking me to be sectioned, IPP, imprisonment for public protection, that means likely for life, and I'd be transferred to Ashworth High Security Prison. And guess what the Queen's representative said? He said, the doctor here believes I have a brain tumour. Now, since that was said, no one's told me. When I came up into the dock, I looked at the eyes of the judge, I looked at the eyes of the prosecutor, and I realised there had been a conversation going on about me. So when I left, I got my sister, who was a magistrate at the time, to quickly order it. And the prison officers were so good to me that day, they let me make a phone call as soon as I got out of the van, before they shredded it. And we caught the tail end on the transcript of the barrister saying, but the doctor here believes I have a brain tumour. His word was cancer. Now, I have been fighting that ever since, because I was due for a hip operation and no doctor in South Wales would see me. I had a GP for 18 years in Cowbridge Health Centre, in Cowbridge, the Vale of Glamorgan. And when I came out of prison, an innocent man, because I had a machine gun, they wouldn't let me be a patient. The police were threatened if I didn't leave the premises. I said, but I wish to know. I've had a brain scans while I was in prison. I want to know the truth about these brain scans. These brain scans were taken at the Princess of Wales Hospital on the 28th of August 2009. Two doctors specialising said, there's not a lot between Morris's ears. Nothing wrong. But this doctor, this psychiatrist, forensic psychiatrist level 12, because he's level 12, he can have you sectioned. And with the new laws that came in 2007, the new Mental Health Act, he can send you to psychiatric prison on his own, and the general public do not know what's going on. And because there's a breakdown of honesty within the law courts, they're finding they can't put the turnover through the courts so well now, and especially with the input of foreign languages that has clogged up a lot of the law courts.
Well, before we go into what you think's wrong with the law courts and what's causing that, tell us about your machine gun offence. I know you mentioned it last time, but you know, wasn't it to do with an aircraft, a machine gun on an aircraft?
Oh, yes, I thought I'd told you about that last time, but my memory is getting a bit bit frail at
my
age.
Yes, because, I mean, anyone is accused of having a machine gun is likely to be thought of as a rather dangerous person, Morris.
Yes, I was accused of having a machine gun and live ammunition, and I thought to myself and smiled as they put the handcuffs on, and I was in prison for 8 months, and they did every trick in the book to get me to use a lawyer. And I knew that if I used a lawyer, I'd go to prison for 10 years. 5 years for having a machine gun, 5 years, and mandatory, for selling it. Now, the fact that I'd bought this old aeroplane in Dorchester 12 years earlier, a basket case, a First World War 1916 DH-2 biplane with a pusher engine, great big engine on the back, like a radial, like a star. And on the front was this decommissioned First World War Lewis machine gun. And a month before the Farnborough Air Show in 2000, I had Trubshaw here on the phone, and I thought it was somebody pulling my leg, my dear friend John Long, who flew the hang glider over the waterfall in Moonraker, and a great mate of mine. We did a lot of... Well, I used to crash a lot, and he used to take me to hospital a lot. And I thought he was pulling my leg. But anyway, I flew it at Farnborough Air Show. I mean, that was the accolade of any young pilot, or ageing pilot, to be able to fly at Farnborough Air Show with this wonderful replica vintage aircraft. Well, anyway, the propeller breaks off on the way back, and I have a spectacular emergency landing on the west coast of Wales. Another long story. Well, I've had 14 engine failures, so that's don't digress. Then I sell the aeroplane to another air museum in Lincolnshire, and a year later, I'm arrested for having the machine gun. And the evidence is that it's this big black gun on the front of this aeroplane that I once owned. But as the jury said to me in the pub afterwards, they said, "Morris, but the guy gave evidence. Why wasn't he in the dock with you?" I said, "Yes, but they also used the Dorchester Museum, who'd had the aeroplane and gun 12 years earlier. They used him as a prosecution witness as well. Why wasn't he?" All politics, you see, because I'm suing the South Wales Police.
So is this, was this machine gun operating? Did you have ammunition?
I have to be careful how I answer that. It was decommissioned. It did not work. The law, the 68 Act, Section 5 is what they were doing me for, was that if I'd put a screwdriver to it or altered it in any way, it would then be illegal. Now, it's interesting that the people who bought it at Lincolnshire painted it silver. So a year later, when I'm arrested, they go to the museum in Lincolnshire, and would you believe, in front of the jury, it was black. Just like the videos on my website of me when I had it on the aircraft and at Farnborough Air Show. Somebody painted it.
Okay, what about the ammunition? Come on.
And when I won the court case, they had to paint it back to black to give it back to the museum. The ammunition. Yes, yes, that is a funny story there. The helicopter was hovering, and we were being surrounded by police cars. And my wife and I and daughter were having cups of tea and saying, "I think somebody wants to talk to me," I said. And I went into my office, and I put on top of my legal papers ammunition for a machine gun. And I was arrested. And sure enough, I got charged with... No, I didn't. I got arrested for having ammunition. And they then dropped it. They dropped the charge. Now, what's interesting is that when the trial started a year later, in the middle of the trial, without me knowing, they visit the house again and take away an Edwardian shooting walking stick. Now, do you know anything about shooting walking sticks? Well, I wouldn't know much, but I've been told they are... You can put a 410 cartridge in, and rumour has it, I heard from my father, an excellent poaching weapon for on the Blackdown Hills or the Quantock Hills around Taunton when you are shooting something that's sitting. Rumour has it. But anyway, they take away this weapon, from my house, which, by the sounds of it, was a prohibited weapon, because it's what you called a disguised thing. Now, why didn't I hear about this until this year, 3 years later? That should have you scratching your head.
Well, it certainly has. Whilst we're scratching, let's have some music from Van Morrison. Gail there, Van Morrison from the album Into the Music, and I'm with Morris Kirk, the flying vet from Somerset, now actually in Cardiff, I believe, Morris.
Well, temporarily, yes.
Tell us about, pick up on the, we were talking about your brain scan there. What happened after, you got the news that apparently there had been a brain scan and apparently, possibly, maybe it was dangerous and possibly there was nothing?
Well, what this psychiatrist, wash your mouth out, Morris, nearly gave you his name, he said that I had significant brain damage. Well, this worried me when I eventually found out. And I went to my GP in Cowbridge, Health Centre, Cowbridge. They refused to see me and so on. So I went to another GP in South Wales, in Barry, and two consultations was enough for them, for me to be banned from the surgery. And I went to a third. Now, I was on morphine twice a day because of my hip had disintegrated and no one would operate. And the anaesthetist in the local private hospital refused to operate, give me an anaesthetic, because I had this record of having significant brain damage. I actually said, "You want me to sign?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Well, I want you to sign as well for my children." And he refused to sign and refused to carry out the operation. I had to go to France to get my hip transplant because I was never going to get it in Wales. Now, it hasn't ended there because I've been to the GMC.
Could you get it in England?
Well, I didn't go further than where I was living. And I expect I may well have been able to get it done in England. I don't know. It's history now. But I went to the GMC, the General Medical Council.
And this is the governing body for doctors, and for basically they look at all potential, I mean, it's a sort of professional body really, a standards body, isn't it?
Yes. And lots of people were chasing the GMC while I was in the psychiatric prison. And a lot of abuse was going on the phones because people were getting very angry that I was locked away there under false pretenses for political things. And the GMC and the IPCC, the Independent Police Complaints Commission, both ignored the evidence. Now that is very, very frightening. Morris Kirk can look after himself, but I was watching that this building was full of people vulnerable very vulnerable people, and I couldn't make up my mind whether their friends who came to visit weren't even more vulnerable.
Well, what's causing that? I mean, is it just tribalism? I mean, a lot of organisations, they are more loyal to their colleagues and their friends than they are to the professional standards they're supposed to be upholding. I mean, that does seem to be a general shift in Britain, at least in whether it's in reality or perception over the last 30, 40 years.
I don't know whether that was a slip of the tongue, tribal, but if you want to talk about South Wales, that is a superb word. The people who live in Swansea are tribal, of a different tribe to those in Cardiff. You watch them when they're playing rugger against each other. They are different, but the medical profession in South Wales are frightening, are very, very frightening, and something must get done about it. And the GMC are sitting on their hands. And the IPCC are sitting on their hands.
Maurice, one of the places where a lot of this gets discussed is the website we mentioned briefly, which is victims-unite.net, run by Sabine McNeil. Just looking at it this week, I mean, it's a blog, isn't it, really?
Yes. And my website...
Well, you can, yes, mention that as well if you wish.
What is it? www.kirkflyingvet.com.
But I mean, the thing with Sabine's site is it brings together a lot of people who are similar to you. That sounds a bit patronising, but people who are in a similar position where they've had miscarriages of justice of one sort or another. A bit like the old, you know, the BBC used to do a series called Rough Justice, I seem to remember, which got scrapped.
I was on Rough Justice.
Really?
I was on Rough Justice, I was interviewed, I was on hunger strike in Guernsey. They had taken away all my, they stopped 63 letters leaving the prison. So I went on hunger strike, I have the record, 35 days for the Channel Islands. And the Rough Justice came to the hospital and they filmed me through the window of the hospital. And the two prison officers were sitting opposite, so they were filming over their shoulders without them seeing. And I had a little card beside me from Oliver Reed, a Christmas card. I remember this was 1984. Yes.
Well, yes, it doesn't exist anymore, unfortunately, that programme, along with a lot of other important documentary programmes which have really been wiped out over
the last
20 years. deep distrust, it says, anyway, on the Victims Unite site. I mean, really, it's largely the internet which has taken over from where these very important programmes... I mean, we only had, whatever, three channels, maybe four channels on the television in Britain, and yet there was far, far more proper investigative documentaries going on. Nowadays, it's thousands of channels, but with nothing.
Yes, virtually. But they haven't got the funding.
They've got Panorama. I mean, don't tell me Panorama haven't got any money.
No.
But they too tend to do sort of slightly surface and safe issues. Getting back to Victims Unite, the on the top of the blog this week, 9th of December, is deep distrust about our political system and the way it's reported by the media, BBC Radio Jersey. So we're back to the Channel Islands again. Give us an idea of what's different between the Channel Islands and the rest of the British Isles.
Well, it's a tax haven. Tax havens are notorious for, in my day, they were I was the veterinary surgeon in Guernsey for 10 years, and I was also the vet on Alderney. Beautiful place. Alderney. Ah, the jewel. And I can't say that about Guernsey. It's like the Cayman Islands. I flew there in my cub. They're like all these tax havens. They are self-centred. They are laundering drug money. They're insider dealing. They hate outsiders. And if you don't join the club when you arrive, especially if you're a professional person, and they realise you are a political activist, like I was, they will make your life misery. I know all about tax havens. And the word incestuous cannot be left out of my sentence.
And as part of that article this week, there's also a little section which is about the different sort of things that which are missed out by the mainstream press, which I rather like. And there's also a link to the Mackenzie's Friends and Public Interest Advocates. But anyway, let's run through them. There's only seven of them, and these are things that the Victims Unite website over a long while And maybe, I'm not sure if this is also connected to other sites, but anyway, the Victims Unite have it up there, is a whole list. I'll just rattle through them. Seven deadly syndromes and seven media cover-ups in the light of Hillsborough and Jimmy Savile. First, secret societies. Then, at number two, mainstream media cover-ups, strategies for gagging and controlling and generally dumbing down. Number three is crimes against children and families. Number four is reporting fraud and white-collar crimes. Five is the illegality and usury of usury and wars. That's usury is interest to you and me. Six, policing, who guards the guards, as we were talking about earlier. Mm. And seven, contest, how the counter-terrorism strategy drives miscarriages of justice. That was compiled by the Association of Mackenzie Friends and Public Interest Advocates. Now, tell us a bit about Mackenzie Friends.
Well, more and more people are trying to do their own litigation, because of the cost or the inconvenience, or they just don't trust lawyers anymore. And therefore, they need people who have a little bit of knowledge to help them. They don't have right of audience, but I've often helped people in court over the last 20, 30 years. I mean, I set up the Guernsey Legal Aid Association in Guernsey, and that's when I first started to be a Mackenzie friend, and that was at least 30 years ago.
But the top of the list, sorry to interrupt you, Maurice, but the top of the list is secret societies, the private lives of public people. Why do you think that's top of the list?
Well, Channel Islands was, of course, Masonic, where Masonic is that a lot of people who follow the Freemasonry religion don't get religious about it. They go there for a good drink and meet friends. But as you know, if you read the subject up and get into the depths of what they're up to, it's devil worship. But it's only devil worship by those senior members of the Masonic movement. Now, Guernsey...
Well, hang on a minute, because I actually spoke to the Grand Master of the Bristol Masonic province about this subject, and he said, well, anyone from any religion can join us. And I said to him, well, what about a Satanist? And he said, well, we don't encourage it. But he didn't actually say no. When you say devil worship, that's a pretty massive accusation. And many of the Freemasons will also say that actually they're not even a religion. It's more of a club with a few rituals, and actually it's kind of like a play.
That is the majority of the system. I treat it like a golf club. It's no different that the golf club is there either to play golf or to meet and make friends of equal brain cells. But I've read the books and I have studied Freemasonry because Freemasonry seriously affected my going to prison in Guernsey. I went to prison for contempt of court.
How do you know that, Maurice? A lot of people will say, oh, it's the Freemasons doing this and that. Have you actually got any evidence?
I have. And also, I left Guernsey at 2 a.m. after a phone call saying, I'd been there for 10 years, that my life, I was going to the bottom of the sea if I didn't leave. And I knew when that man was talking the truth. And I was...
But come on, let's have evidence
and
about
the
Freemason connection.
I'm not disclosing my sources on that subject, but I had to get in my rubber boat and leave the island and the two houses I owned, and I left there very, very frightened. And the minute I was in my rubber boat getting away from Guernsey, I felt a lot better for it. And I didn't go back for 19 years, and I went back last Christmas and was interviewed on the radio and television and so on and so on. I was frightened, very frightened.
A lot more to talk about, Maurice, but we have to leave it there for the time being. I think maybe back in the new year, you're up for that?
Oh, some flying stories, which I've been holding back for you.
Lovely. Well, thanks ever so much. And now we're moving on to talk to Jason Yiannakopoulos. Hi, Jason.
Oh, hello. Oh, I didn't realise it was going to be so quickly. I thought
we're charging straight into our chat with you. Jason, you've come along today prepared with a bit of info about the Black Triangle campaign.
Black Triangle campaign has was started, as I explained last week, as one of many groups who are opposed to who are opposed to Atos and the whole problem with the way the government has been attacking disabled people.
And this is the assessments
The assessments and the welfare to work.
And the black triangle coming from something that the Nazis did, I believe.
Yeah, well, it's it was a symbol for disabled people at Auschwitz and other concentration camps. For disabled people was a black triangle, so that's why they call themselves the Black Triangle Group, because they feel... There are a lot of disabled people who feel that they're being almost targeted and eliminated in the same manner, in a way.
Okay, what about people being forced to work?
That's a welfare to work. And, I mean, this is one of the major things that the Black Triangle campaign are campaigning against. It's absolutely shocking, because you look at it, there's about 30,000 people who were... You know, there's a large number of people who were receiving benefits, and, you know, the 99% of them were receiving them fairly. The fact is, with these benefits being removed and the welfare to work, there's a good 30,000 people at any one time being forced into work. And admittedly, it's not all disabled people, but it's also people who have been unemployed for a while, but mainly other people on different sorts of benefits, and they're still being forced to work. And that is... It's a huge number. It was really thousands. I mean, 30,000 disabled people in particular, I've read on the Black Triangle campaign website.
Being part of the problem I have with this, you know, is that you've got the Department for Social Security, DSS, farming out the work to ATOS. It's almost like it's one step removed. It's a kind of privatisation of government, in a way. That money, taxpayers' money, is handed over to this private business. But anyway, why ATOS?
Well, the reason ATOS was chosen... I don't understand what the reason ATOS was chosen, because ATOS is actually an IT company. ATOS, the assessment has been done by ATOS Healthcare, so it's a healthcare wing of what is actually a French IT company. So,
well, I mean, they're able to hire doctors like anyone else, surely.
Well, yes, it's doctors, it's nurses, it's social workers, and it's almost the way it's done. I mean, they have the chats with these people. They come in, they ask questions, they have the chats with these people, and then they can say to somebody like the man whose story I read, who's completely unable to walk, that, you know, okay, you're able to work, off you go.
And so what happens in that sort of situation? Can people appeal?
Yes, I mean, people appeal, and you know, at the moment we've had cases where 40%, in some cases even higher than that, of appeals have been successful. So it's not very secure, and it's... The whole ATOS thing is—it's not very well thought out. It's not very well planned, and it's actually quite dangerous in a way, because they're forcing people to work. They're forcing these disabled people to work for actually no money at all.
What makes you say that? Surely they're getting something.
No, because these are all internships, and the internships don't actually guarantee any further jobs, so they don't actually get any progression on that either.
Oh, so what are the major problems with the DWP? Now, see, I said DSS earlier, didn't I? If you noticed, but it's not the DSS anymore. It's the Department for Work and Pensions. What are the major problems with the welfare to work plan then?
Well, that's precisely it, as I was explaining, is that a lot of the people are just being forced into work for little to no money, might not be kept, because, of course, it only runs every 6 months and they have to get reassessed. They might not be kept, and it doesn't actually guarantee any progression. So effectively, this is almost slavery.
It sounds a bit frightening, especially when you're talking about the Black Triangle of Auschwitz. What are the Black Triangle campaign? I mean, the website is Black Triangle Campaign. That's one. Well, it's three words, isn't it? All run into one. Black Triangle, in a kind of German way. That's what the Germans do. They run all their words into one, don't they? But anyway, that's online. That's online. The Black Triangle Campaign, all one word, .org is where you'll find them. But who are they allied with, Jason?
Well, they're allied with many other groups, such as Disabled People Against Cuts, and one which I thought was quite interesting, Victims of ATOS. There's actually a group called Victims of ATOS. It's quite interesting, because a lot of these... And there was a site that was called Atos experience, where people detailed their Atos experience, but Atos actually got a legal thing to get that shut down.
Well, that sounds awful, because that should be about freedom of expression. If someone has had, you know, surely if they're going to a journalist with a story about being treated badly by Atos, then that's sounds like they've got some good lawyers and a lot of money, these people, to try and make sure the public make sure the public don't find out what they're up to. Quite a nasty crew. Anyway, Atos, if you're listening, give us a call, dialect at BCFM, the number here, 0117 955 3721. You can contact the station, and we'd like to find out why you're treating disabled people this way. On now to our item on Alan Frankovich, US filmmaker. His name is Alan Frankovich. He made the definitive film for Channel 4 about the Lockerbie bombing, which was never repeated, but which you can view online. It's called The Maltese Double Cross, and it suggests there was a secret motive for the United States to actually blow up the Pan Am flight at Lockerbie. He also directed a three-part Operation Gladio film for the BBC Time Watch series, which was shown to stunned audiences in 1992. It documented NATO blowing up European civilians and blaming it on the Russians, the Red Brigades, the Baader-Meinhof Group, and even the IRA. Frankovich died in mysterious circumstances in Houston Airport Customs Hall in 1994. Alongside the feature films of Greek-born French filmmaker Costa Gavras, Frankovich's 70s and 80s documentaries give us a deep insight into the criminal side of Western intelligence agencies such as MI6, the CIA, the Israeli Mossad, and NATO intelligence. All these secret political operations being deniable, but carried out under the secret orders of prime ministers, presidents, and royalty. Frankovich was interviewed in October 1982 by Alternative View in Austin, Texas, just after he released In Company Business, his film On Company Business, that should be, his film all about the CIA. Frankovich described the CIA as a kind of Rotary Club version of the Nazis' hated secret police, the Gestapo.
For instance, one of the persons interviewed in the film is a former president of CBS News, the founding president of CBS News and Public Affairs, and he says that when he became president of CBS News, they had a relationship with the CIA. He had inherited this relationship, and it involved providing cover to CIA representatives. But it also involved, and this is incredible, providing any material they had in their news library to the CIA. For instance, the CIA wanted to identify somebody in a country who was leading a demonstration. So you're dealing with a level of collusion, and you're dealing with the fact that there is a level of contact at the top level of the networks, and they're reaching 50 million people a night. So what the CIA is concerned about, they're not concerned about a little book or a little newspaper article in the Nation. They're concerned about things which really tell you the truth about what they're doing. And in this case, in CIA on company business, it's entirely told you by people in the agency. And then reaching a large number of people. Because the very reason they keep their operations secret is because if they try to explain them to us, they would find very little to justify them. And since this country is still a democracy, we're still allowed to vote, and God knows how long that's going to continue, it's going to be, they have to do this thing in secret. In other words, they're keeping them not so much from the other countries, because I'm sure, for instance, in the case of Chile, that the government of Chile knew the CIA was trying to destroy their government. They're trying to keep them from us. And that's why they are very upset with some of the people who wrote books which were much more forthcoming than they would like to be. And that's why this film, because it has reached a very large audience, is of concern to them now. But when it was being made, I don't think they really cared one way or another.
At what point did the CIA begin harassing you, if they did? And if so, how did they do it? Did they try to block the distribution in any way? Did they try to defame you?
Particularly since the people who wrote books have been taken to court.
Well, you see, the difference is that I never worked for the CIA. Philip Agee and John Stackwell did work for the CIA, okay. And therefore they have a contractual obligation with the CIA. The second thing is that everything in that film is so thoroughly documented. In other words, as I said, everybody tells you what they did. And for instance, William Colby talks about the program they had in Chile and tells you that it was a program that started in the 60s, where they channeled a massive sum of money into political parties, which would be just like the Korean CIA deciding that they wanted to fund the Republican Party with $20 million. They're doing exactly the same thing. It's the structure of the film which is the problem, because, as I said, you go through 35 years of history, you see all kinds of things which people did not know. So the way they have dealt with the film is the film was actually shown on the public broadcasting system in 1980. And that was because there were people in the public broadcasting system who saw that this film was going to be an historic document. It was going to be was going to go down as one of the most important documentaries made in the last so many years. What they did not realize was the kind of political pressure they were going to get, and so therefore the response, it was supposed to be shown three times, it was shown once, and they got enormous pressure, and it was yanked. That's the first thing. The second thing is, rather than deal with any of the facts and challenge any of the facts, they have concocted an international campaign, which is one of the standard things they use, accusing me of being an international terrorist. And I'm the kind of person who doesn't even know how to load a 38 caliber pistol. And what they did there was that they took, for instance, certain, I'll give you an example. When I was a student at the University of California, myself and my girlfriend and now my wife and some other people, we organized a film society on campus. And the purpose of this was to show films, raise money, buy equipment so that students would be able to make films. And we called it the Film Liberation Front. So, in other words, in this speech and some other Planet articles, a speech that Congressman Larry McDonald made from Georgia, he goes on my background and he brings up Alan Frankovich, notorious founder of the Film Liberation Front at Berkeley, and what he doesn't say is that I was a fellow of the American Film Institute in 1969, and the next year a fellow at the American Federation of Arts. And so there's this campaign trying to link us through the very conservative, extreme right-wing press, Accuracy and Media, mm-hmm. Conservative Digest, because they're trying to ignore giving us any attention, getting into a controversy, like the controversy they got into with Missing. But then there's another level, is that in some countries, and the one very specific example is Australia. In Australia, the film was a smash hit at the Sydney Film Festival, then ran 14 to 16 weeks at a big theater in Sydney and then in the other cities. And so when I was there, I was invited to show the film to the leadership of the Australian Labor Party, which is like the British Labor Party or the Democratic Party here. It's more or less that tendency. The American ambassador found out about this, called up the National Secretary of the Labor Party and threatened them. But again, didn't argue that there was anything in the film that was inaccurate. Threatened them that if they came to power again, the United States government would be in the position of having to reconsider relations with this. And this is what's incredible. This is a sovereign country, a political party in a foreign country, which has every right to see anything they want to, particularly a film which had already been shown on public broadcasting here.
And it's only a film. It's not that.
I'm quite willing to get into an open debate on any form they want with anyone where we can talk about these things. As a matter of fact, that's what the film was made to accomplish. Because I don't see CBS doing it, and you can understand why. If the moment they started bringing it out, they would be in the position of having to acknowledge their own involvement. And you see, the CIA likes to do that. They like to get you involved, and then they will blackmail you.
What has been the reception in the United States? Now, when it played here for a benefit for John Stockwell over at the law school auditorium, the place was packed. The right wing could have wiped out all the progressive people in Austin with one well-placed bomb. They were all there that night.
Well, the reviews have been very, very good. And where it's played, it's got very large audiences. But we're having to put in the effort to actually get it released again, because there are obstacles, and some of the obstacles are commercial obstacles, have to do with the nature of who owns theaters in this country, and the fact that documentaries, you have to prove that a documentary will have an audience before it will be booked. And some of them have to do with their attempt really to keep us from reaching this audience, and you have to realize that they have contacts with a lot of people in the media in this country. And I'm not saying that necessarily a lot of people have been bought by them, but they have the capacity to blackmail them, and they also they can make a journalist's reputation simply by leaking to him the right kind of information at the right time. That's an enormous power, and if you're an ambitious journalist, you take that into consideration. They have all kinds of ways of corrupting the whole process of the free press.
That was US filmmaker Alan Frankovich speaking to the Austin, Texas VHS video news magazine Alternative Views way back in 1982. More from Alan next week. Now, though, Jeff Sparks and the What's On Guide.
Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 14th of December, Bella Hardy will be performing at the Folk House in Park Street, Bristol. Tickets are £12 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Moving into Saturday, 15th of December, Little Angels will be performing with support from Skin and Chrome Molly at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Tickets are £18.50 in advance and doors open at 7 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Widowmaker. This group formed in 1975 and split up in 1977 and released two albums. The lineup featured Steve Ellis from Love Affair, Luther Grosvenor from Mott the Hoople and Spooky Tooth, Bob Daisley from Chicken Shack, Paul Nicholls from Lindisfarne, and Hugh Lloyd Langton from Hawkwind. On 6th of December 2012, Hugh passed away, aged 61. Here I play tribute to Hugh Lloyd Langton with a song from Widowmaker's self-titled first album, and the song is titled Straight-Faced Fighter. Was Widowmaker with a Straight-Faced Fighter from their self-titled first album. Staying with 15th of December, Gunpowder Plot will be performing with support from Poe Lice and also the Migraines at the Croft in Stokes Croft, Bristol. Tickets are £5 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Finally, on Sunday 16th of December, the Devin Townsend Project will be performing with support from Fear Factory at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Tickets are £17 in advance and doors open at 7 p.m. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thanks very much, Jeff. Well, that's all this week. Dialect's a weekly podcast for your MP3 player produced by volunteers. And if you're outside Bristol and on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Thursday when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download this weekly podcast from our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our studio guests this week, Morris Kirk and Jason Yannakopoulos. Dialect's a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, which you can find on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. As promised, here's the number again for Bristol Bully Watch Helpline. That's 01454 318 753. That was Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, and wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. So, till the same time next week, goodbye.
Yeah.